You're listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research conference podcast. I'm the center's director, Ann Stevens. In October 2015, the center hosted the conference Employment, Earnings, and Inequality: Realities and Opportunities in Low-Wage Labor Markets. The conference featured experts on labor markets who presented both quantitative and qualitative research on a wide variety of topics, including wages, shifts in occupations, immigration, and the lives of low-skilled workers. In this presentation, Jeffrey Clements discusses his work on how the Great Recession affected employment and income for low-skilled workers. Clements is an assistant professor in the Department of Economics at UC San Diego.
Okay, so I think if there's a common theme here in at least the last two presentations of the day, it's that public finance economists in their 30s think it's interesting to look at the minimum wage interacting with stuff. And so this will be the minimum wage interacting with stuff, specifically eligibility notches associated with public health insurance benefits through the Medicaid program. And I guess just one thing to flag kind of at the top is that whereas sort of Day's analysis of the minimum wage and the earned income tax credit is a pretty kind of broad full population thing, what I'm going to be analyzing is going to be sort of an attempt, it's going to be an attempt to learn something about what's going on in low-skilled labor markets that's going to be sort of specific to a relatively narrow group of the population. So this paper is joint work with Michael Wither, who was one of my grad students at UCSD and has since abandoned me for the private sector, leaving me to kind of steer the ship all by myself. And this is the first paper that I would say that I've written where the kind of the what I would at least hope to think of as being the big ideas lurking in the background were very much a product of having taught the portion of UCSD's undergrad and grad public finance sequences, which is about low-income support programs. And having had that experience of teaching the grad version of that course three times and the undergraduate course two times, I basically have kind of two main observations that have come out of that. The first is that there are a tremendous number of programs that are associated with the landscape for supporting low-income folks to the extent that we actually refer to it as the patchwork of policy instruments, and it's such that you could basically burn through the entire 5 weeks that we devote to this material at UCSD just by standing there and describing the landscape of the program. So at some point you have to get on to the theory and the empirical work, but you could stand there talking about the landscape of programs for the full 5 weeks. So just to provide a little bit of a flavor of kind of how I think about the kind of topology of these programs, so if you start thinking about sort of money income or cash-based assistance, you know, we have progressive tax code, we have means-tested sort of traditional cash welfare benefits, we have wage subsidies that are tax-financed in the form of the earned income tax credit, and then we have wage regulation in the form of the minimum wage. And you can turn to sort of another huge landscape, namely the health insurance landscape, where we have tax-financed, you know, public insurance benefits, so the Medicaid program. We have tax-financed purchases, subsidies for purchasing insurance on the exchanges. And then, again, we have a case of sort of regulatory approaches, in particular the regulations against insurance companies charging different premiums to people who have pre-existing conditions. And then you can move into other domains, so you can move into housing, and you get sort of the same typology where you have tax-financed public housing projects, you have tax-financed, you know, vouchers or other sort of subsidy arrangements, and you have rent control as a kind of regulatory approach. And then to make it even more complicated, many of these things are sort of they're sort of state, local, and national versions of these types of efforts. So it's sort of a tremendously complicated environment. And when we go to explain how we think about, well, do we want it to be a complicated environment or do we not want it to be a complicated environment, what we typically describe this patchwork as being pitted against is sort of the simplest possible way that you could imagine setting up a single program to eradicate poverty, which would be to just set up a basic income grant that's set to equal the poverty level income for a household of a given size, or maybe a little bit more generous, and then to tax that away with a rate structure which is progressive so that then you've got your high income folks both financing the grants to the super low income people and also the other stuff that government does. So that sounds simple. It eliminates poverty, kind of by definition of how you've set it up. So what's wrong with that? Well, what we usually walk through as we talk about what's wrong with that is that it's sort of ill-targeted on a couple of dimensions. So for one, it's a pretty clunky way, the kind of poverty line is a pretty clunky way of thinking about sort of total household need, in particular when you think about the differential health needs, say, of households that have a member that has a disability or that has some sort of expensive chronic health condition. And so you can see how that's why you kind of get rationales for bringing sort of maybe a health-focused component into your redistributive system. It's also ill-targeted in the sense that it has no bells or whistles, or it doesn't really do anything to kind of screen out people who we might think of as being sort of relatively unneedy or sort of potentially capable of taking care of themselves and would do so, you know, in the absence of this program existing. And so as we walk through the different elements of the patchwork, there are these great and very simple papers that are theory papers on this portion of the public finance syllabus, which walk you through arguments for how these different elements of the patchwork can kind of work to serve these functions of better targeting benefits at the people who we think really need to receive them. What I think we're really bad at in this portion of the public finance syllabus is thinking not so much about the straw man of do you want to do it through one program or through a bunch of programs, but about thinking about this problem on the margin. I.e., if we had some additional state resources and we were going to think about how to best to deploy them, would we be better off sort of adding another kind of targeting or screening mechanism or sort of a new type of benefit? Or would we be better off scaling up, you know, the set of benefits that we kind of already that we already have in place? And so that's kind of the broad sort of agenda that I'm kind of trying to get at, and that I think Day is getting at as well in this kind of program interaction portion of the low income support literature. So sorry, that was a very long-winded observation number one. Observation number two is that the parts of this patchwork of policy instruments move pretty regularly, and this has been particularly dramatic in recent years. So, you know, we have dramatic changes in the health insurance landscape through the Affordable Care Act. In the context of the recession, you know, the generosity of food stamps was temporarily increased and then scaled back. The duration of unemployment insurance benefits was pretty dramatically increased and then scaled back. And then, of course, the minimum wage has sort of changed, you know, at the state and federal level with great frequency over the last several decades. Now, of course, many of the changes in these policies you would think of as being kind of meaningful reform, but some of the changes also seem to have the flavor of, you know, if there are a bunch of policy levers, it's like Democrats want to run down the aisle, hitting them all up in the direction of more redistribution, and then Republicans try to come in to, you know, put them all down in the direction of less redistribution, and that's kind of what I'm getting at when I use this sort of pejorative sounding term, tinkering. And of course, the policy reform that you favor is meaningful reform, but then when you look at the idiot next to you, the policy that they prefer is the one that's kind of the senseless tinkering about with the system. So the question that I wanted to ask and that I'm exploring in this paper is the question of whether or not this kind of tinkering is costly to beneficiaries. And if it's literally the case of just sort of moving a lever in one direction and then moving it back, I think we would all have the sense that at best that could be sort of a neutral action, and at worst is probably going to have some costs. But what I want to think about more rigorously in the context of this paper is sort of under what conditions would you expect there to be costs associated with that tinkering about with the system? And then to go to the data in a very particular kind of selected scenario and get a sense for whether or not these costs appear to be manifesting themselves. So to be a little bit more analytic about it, what's going to drive whether or not this sort of shifting about of program parameters is costly? When we shift around program parameters, essentially what we're doing, you know, if we were giving a lecture to undergraduates in economics, we're shifting around the budget constraints or the opportunity sets that they face. And so the question of whether there are going to be costs to kind of shifting it in one direction and then pulling it back really rides on how difficult it is for people to adjust to this change in the opportunity set that they face. And there are kind of two different flavors of adjustment frictions or adjustment costs that I want to highlight. So one is informational. So it could be that programs are changing in ways that would lead a low-income household to want to rearrange its affairs if it was sort of fully aware of what had happened to the landscape, but that not everyone, you know, is quick on the uptake or sort of knows that the program landscape has. And I don't mean that pejoratively, because just keeping track of the whole thing, you know, is difficult enough if you're a professional public finance economist and this is your job. So it's, you know, it would actually probably be irrational to be paying attention to how all of the program parameters are changing. So I think we have some excellent work on precisely this point. So as Marianne Page was pointing out economists don't say a lot in praise of one another when they introduce them to speak, so the junior economists have to band together and reference one another's work when it's good and it's on these things. So Day has a paper that's forthcoming in the American Economic Review. It's not out yet. It's still in press. Which is on sort of precisely these issues in the context of the earned income tax credit, to which he's devoted a great deal of study. One of the earlier papers that I had read that got me thinking about these kinds of issues was some of Anna Iser from Brown University's work on potential impediments to people taking up Medicaid benefits for which they're eligible. And when you think about this framing that I gave at the top, you know, if we're thinking about adding a new layer or wrinkle to the eligibility rules or the program space as a way of kind of better targeting benefits, but we're making things so complicated that people can't keep track of the information, then those kinds of costs are going to sort of erode the benefits associated with whatever, you know, frictionless optimal screening model we had in mind when we, you know, when we recommended the program. Yeah.
So you're sort of saying that if I, you know, toggle the switch back and forth, like $100 worth of benefits, $200 back and down, this has a cost. But that's sort of assuming a model like, what if I just always assume I have $100 and every once in a while, maybe not like as often as I'm capable, like under the rules, but like an extra $100 shows up in my pocket. Like,
yeah. So for cash benefits, I completely agree with you. So the scenario that I'll be looking at is going to involve transitions onto and off of insurance, where I think this is more important. But yeah, if it's literally just a lump of money, and some months it's $200, and some months it's $100, if you just ignore what's happening and note that the average is $150, then you'd be fine. Right. Yes. Yeah, so I'll be thinking more about when there are settings where a price is changing. So an incentive like your effective net of tax wage rate, or these insurance margins where you might actually worry that the thing that's turning on and off is affecting some kind of continuity of care type of margin. But yeah, I think that's a good point. Okay. So information impediments. That's adjustment costs number one, on which we have some good evidence in the literature. Adjustment cost number two would be of the form, you recognize what's happened to your budget set or your opportunity set, but it is just difficult, you know, because you're in a particular job and that employer kind of needs you to show up for a given number of hours a week. It might be difficult for you to kind of seamlessly tweak those hours of work in response to whatever change in your opportunity set has taken place. And so here again, you know, unsurprisingly, economists have been on the case. This is sort of obvious stuff on some level. It is costly to adjust. So we have some very good work, which has sort of, I'll emphasize, focused largely on the elderly population and then on kind of middle and relatively high-income taxpayers. And so the analysis that I'm conducting in this paper and that I'm presenting to you today is going to involve an opportunity to look at a scenario where it is very much kind of low-skilled folks, a sort of particularly low-skilled, low-earning set of individuals, and we'll be sort of exploring the relevance of labor market adjustment costs in that setting. Specifically, I'll be looking at how the employment, the Medicaid benefit receipt, and the job search of sort of low-wage Medicaid beneficiaries shift after a shift in the eligibility notch, which is going to be associated with recent changes in the minimum wage. And I think about this very much as an opportunity to learn about frictions in these labor markets for low-skilled folks. Yeah?
So would something like a business cycle, like fluctuation in policy in response to business cycle variation be tinkering, or would that, like if there's a recession and I make unemployment durations longer, or the potential duration of benefits longer, is that tinkering, or is that...
No, well, I mean, both... So, in general, I guess I would think of what I'm doing as abstracting from fiscal type policy type of considerations. But I guess as you're probably very familiar, like even if you didn't have a stimulus type of motivation associated with the policy, when you crank through your optimal unemployment insurance formula and you note that the elasticity is probably changing across the business cycle, that would actually be so that would be meaningful reform as opposed to sort of futzing about, so to speak. Okay, so the plan for the rest of the talk, so I'm going to walk you not so much through theory as just kind of the particulars of the empirical setting that I'll be looking at, talking a little bit about the data, showing some initial evidence that, you know, I have at least kind of found a sample of workers who were very much sort of affected by the minimum wage changes that I'll be analyzing, and then I'll proceed to follow what happens with these individuals' participation in the Medicaid program, their employment, and their self-reported job search. Okay, so the basic setting here, as I've been emphasizing, you know, the program landscape is very complicated. I just want to focus on kind of a two-element program landscape. So consider a set of individuals who are in the following circumstances. We're going to assume that they're all employed at a legally binding minimum wage and that they can potentially participate in some benefit, specifically that's going to be Medicaid, which is contingent on having income below some threshold. So this is what I mean when I refer to an eligibility notch. As opposed to being a benefit like cash welfare, where you start with some grant and that's gradually taxed away, Medicaid has historically been, you know, a benefit where you have this insurance, which is can be worth, you know, thousands of dollars, in particular at the household level, and that benefit goes from being thousands of dollars worth of insurance to zero if your income, you know, crosses some threshold. An insight from basic theory, which, you know, you can work through with a bunch of diagrams if you want, but which I'll avoid doing today, is that, you know, many individuals would ultimately, in this scenario, find it attractive to kind of earn the income that's exactly the amount at the threshold, so that they kind of have the maximal income that would allow them to kind of continue receiving this benefit. Okay, so that's the basic setup. The question that I'm going to ask is, what happens to these individuals if policymakers tinker, and in the mathematical sense, I'm going to mean kind of incrementally change one of the program parameters. And so we have two of them. In the empirical work, I'll be focusing on the minimum wage, but we could also think about the threshold. So basically, the example would be a marginal increase in the minimum wage, which has the effect of reducing the number of hours that you can work that would let you remain on this benefit program. Alternatively, you could think about just more directly shifting the eligibility threshold itself, having kind of a similar effect on the budget set of the relevant people.
So yeah. In this sense, does your definition of tinkering sort of lead to the unexpected changes that otherwise people wouldn't be working at exactly the threshold? They may give themselves some margin if I know that.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. And in the empirical setting, just to be clear, it's not going to be the case that the people are kind of in any meaningful sense, like right there. They're going to be kind of at a range of earnings that are sort of in, you know, within striking distance, so to speak, of the eligibility notch.
Just to sort of the general context, I want to think about unexpected change in increase in the minimum wage as opposed to, you know, the minimum wage is indexed and everybody sort of knows that it's going to go up.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, so getting back to the point I was making earlier about adjustment costs, so the implications of a change of this sort for beneficiaries will depend very much on how difficult it is to adjust. So the straw man of the kind of no adjustment costs, frictionless world is a world where policy changes of this sort will have a vanishingly small impact on any outcome that you might consider looking at. And the reason for that is that essentially all of the individuals who were literally working at the income or at the number of hours that put them at the notch would find it optimal to just marginally scale back hours so that what you would see in the data would be no change in program participation, no change in the labor force participation in terms of the extensive margin, are they working or are they not working. You would, you know, probably have a statistically indetectable, you know, change in the number of hours. And well-being would be up marginally because they would be enjoying a little bit more leisure time and working a little bit less. Okay, so that's the world of seamless adjustment. When you go to start thinking about the world where there are adjustment costs, then you have to make some choices about the particulars of the adjustment costs that you're going to inject. So I'm going to totally kind of bypass that. You can read our three-page theory section in the paper if you want to kind of get a look at the flavor. But a variety of adjustment costs would generate the following set of differential empirical predictions relative to the seamless adjustment case. So suppose that it's difficult to find a job that would let you do this marginal increase in the number of hours that you work, or you could just insert the information friction that you didn't know and it kind of snuck up on you that you were now out of eligibility status for this program. So in this case, we can see very, very different outcomes. Specifically, we may see that some individuals end up continuing sort of their same labor supply, but ultimately ending up off of Medicaid or off of the benefit program. We might see some individuals who end up exiting the labor force altogether in order to kind of search for a job that would allow them to actually retain eligibility for the program while working. And then it's sort of trivial to note that in a world where there are no search costs or adjustment frictions, there's no search. But in a world where there are search costs and adjustment frictions, then there is search. And that search is costly, and it's something that the government should take into account if it shifts around people's sort of need to look for particular types of jobs. And the policy reform here is it's a straw man in the sense that it's set up so that it doesn't do any good. That's the point of the tinkering side. And so all of these three outcomes are associated with costs, and so we would conclude that well-being would decline unambiguously as a result of tinkering in a world where there are a lot of these types of frictions. One thing that's a little bit interesting, maybe to note, just in terms of the kind of theory, is that if you do your budget constraint diagram and you draw your indifference curves, you would ultimately observe that there would be some types who would want to engage in search for the new job that's at the notch from the old job, but there could also be some types who would want to engage in that search from outside of the labor market altogether, and that's just a matter of what the specifics of what their utility functions look like. So that's all in the paper. Okay, so as we go into the wild or go into the data, things are going to be messy, and that's true for a couple of reasons. So the first is that one of the things that I think has been sort of a source of some consternation within the minimum wage literature is that it's difficult to isolate samples where anything more than say like 20% or 30% of the people in the sample are actually minimum wage workers. So that's a somewhat difficult thing to do. We're going to be working with panel data from the Survey of Income and Program Participation, where we'll be able to do sort of reasonably well on this margin by looking at the wages that people were earning during the periods that immediately preceded the enactment of the minimum wage increases that we'll be analyzing. Okay, second, Medicaid eligibility also turns out to be sort of much messier in practice than you might think. So Medicaid eligibility thresholds, I find this kind of bizarre, but so they're all stated as technically being on the basis of monthly income. Of course, none of them are actually enforced on the basis of monthly income. Once you're on Medicaid, almost all states, I think it's something like 47 states, do 12 monthly assessments of your income or your qualifying earnings, and then assess your continuing eligibility on the basis of that. A few states do it on a 6-month basis. This is also kind of a bizarre thing just in terms of program coordination to note that subsidies for which people are eligible on the exchanges are based on annual, tax information, whereas Medicaid eligibility technically is being done on a monthly basis. Just sort of more stuff that could stand to be better coordinated in this space. Yeah?
Can I ask my 12-month review, am I being assessed over my prior 12 months or over my prior month?
Prior month, now.
Is this a change that was part of ACA?
It's always been Medicaid's been on monthly income, and that's right, the ACA is on annual income.
So it sounds like
and under the new law, everything has to be done annually now. A number of states used to do it.
But so, I mean, my presumption with a lot of this stuff is that, and in some level this is a punt, and if I wasn't an economist, I would talk to people, about it and get more actual information. Part of my assumption is that this is surely something that varies from eligibility assessor to eligibility assessor, just in terms of the details of sort of what that process is when they encounter you and ask you about your income receipts and decide whether or not to really push the line if you're like a buck over the threshold and all that. Other issues that make it difficult to sort of be very precise with Medicaid eligibility in the data are that, so you observe earning self-reports. Those come with measurement error. And additionally, the sort of income or earnings concept that's relevant for Medicaid eligibility, involves things, disregards sort of expenses for transport to work, childcare, and some things of this flavor, which make it so that it's difficult to know sort of how exactly an individual's household circumstances translate into kind of what their self-reported income means about where they are relative to the eligibility threshold. So the scenario that I'll be analyzing is sort of, to some extent, I'll argue, going to make this not as devastating or as important as you might otherwise think it would be. So I'm going to be analyzing low-wage Medicaid beneficiaries from a period that's going to run from 2008 into 2012, which will be a period that includes the last round of increases in the federal minimum wage, namely from a level of $5.15 to a level of $7.25, which, importantly for my strategy, was differentially binding across states. So I'll have some low-wage Medicaid beneficiaries in states where the minimum wage is going up by quite a bit over this time period, and some low-wage Medicaid beneficiaries who are in states where the minimum wage is changing very little over this time period.
Taking into account state changes in the minimum wage over that time period,
I'll show a graph that shows the average effective minimum wage rates over the two groups, kind of over the full time period, and at least during the period when the SIP is on, so starting with, you know, with 2008, there were very few states specific. So some, that's kind of the active. There was basically a lull between the last increment of the federal and then kind of three years out. So there's very little in the sample. What's important to note in terms of the group that I'll be looking at here is that, sort of to a varying degree across states, but in particular in the states where the minimum wage increases were binding, and this very much reflects that this is kind of a red states, blue states world, the Medicaid eligibility thresholds for parents, not the eligibility thresholds which are more generous for pregnant women, but just for parents, are remarkably low, almost startlingly low. So often in sort of red states, during this period, and still to the extent that those states have not adopted the ACA's Medicaid expansion, parents have eligibility thresholds which are on the order of 40% of the federal poverty line. So if we think about the federal poverty line for 2009 for a family of three, and we use the percent of poverty line eligibility thresholds for sort of a select group of states, what we see is that in Texas, the relevant threshold would have been just under $5,000, in Kansas, under $6,000, and in Mississippi, just right in at $8,000. While full-time minimum wage work at the sort of minimum wage that was in effect at the very beginning of my sample, which is the minimum wage from July 2008 until June 2009, full-time work at that minimum wage would have put you at $13,000. So it's essentially, it's impossible to have a full-time minimum wage job and to retain eligibility for Medicaid as an adult in these states. And over this full-time period, as you see a 40% increase in the minimum wage, that essentially means that you've gone from a world where in Texas you would already have to be kind of working like 17 hours a week at most if you wanted to be on Medicaid, and then that goes down to 10 hours. And there are essentially no jobs that are 10-hour-a-week jobs in the sense of sort of regular work. You might be able to find odd jobs that you cobble together like that, but if you have an employer who expects you to, serve some function, it's almost certainly going to be something that's more than 10 hours a week. So because these eligibility thresholds are so low, I'll feel comfortable sort of empirically just thinking about the full population of adult Medicaid beneficiaries as people who are sort of not implausibly far from being in this sort of very particular scenario where a 40% kind of in total ratcheting up of the minimum wage significantly changes the extent to which you could engage in sort of meaningful market work and retain eligibility for Medicaid. And so I guess this is one of these points where, at least in California, we can say, okay, well, at least we're not in that situation. I think that this is actually a very interesting, this will be something interesting to analyze as we get more data following the Affordable Care Act, specifically the kind of reverse of this experiment, which is that the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansions have made it so that a sort of potential, a low-skilled Medicaid beneficiary could engage in meaningful work and sort of retain continuous access to insurance through Medicaid and then transitioning onto the exchanges. So I wouldn't be surprised if one, if one dug into the data, if one found that there was an increase in labor force participation among relatively low-skilled folks in states, that enacted the Medicaid expansions. So I'll be on the case. Maybe you will too. We'll see if that plays out. Yeah.
So what you're saying, right? It's also that would just be true for the month prior to like establishing eligibility or reestablishing eligibility. That the other 11 months of the year you could be working just like you wanted.
Yeah, that's something that I want to look into in a little more detail. I mean, I suspect that they wouldn't let you just show up and say I only worked 10 hours this last week.
Officially. for doing anything on it, but it's a good question.
Okay.
You officially lose eligibility, but but it's not this.
Right.
It's
not right. Okay, so I've been moving painfully slowly, unfortunately, although this has been, I hope this has been fun. So the next slide is going to have basically a look at the main results of the paper, and then the rest of the slides sort of walk through some of the details about what I worry about and kind of what I need to probe in the empirical analysis in order to sort of flesh this out. But so this is kind of the main takeaway figure from the paper. So what I'm plotting out here are separating out individuals who were in the states that were bound by these increases in the minimum wage from individuals who were in states that were not bound by these increases in the minimum wage. I'm plotting, you know, just the time series of the fraction of months that these individuals are in panel A, managing to both be employed and report being on Medicaid. Then in panel B, separating that out to just the Medicaid participation. In panel C, looking at just employment. And then in panel D, looking at the number of weeks that these individuals report that they're looking for work. And so what we can see is that in panel A, the sort of main outcome of interest, you know, can you sort of retain employment and participation in the Medicaid program? It looks like as we sort of come through the July 2009 increase in the minimum wage, there begins to be a departure in sort of your ability to maintain employment and Medicaid participation between the bound states and the unbound states, with individuals in bound states becoming about 15 percentage points less likely to sort of maintain this joint outcome of employment and Medicaid participation. When we look at the Medicaid participation, we see something very similar. It's kind of this large gap sort of opening up on the order of about 14 percentage points. When we look at employment, one thing that's kind of interesting on this particular sample of low-wage Medicaid beneficiaries is that their employment actually looks like it kind of holds steady, comparing the bound states to the unbound states, for the first few months following the increase in the minimum wage. But then as the kind of Medicaid, you know, eligibility or Medicaid participation appears to lapse, you see some people leaving the labor force. And this is something that that I find incredibly interesting, just in terms of, in this context, when you analyze what happened following increases in the minimum wage. Typically in the minimum wage literature, everything is just treated as though it's telling you about some labor demand elasticity coming from firms. What I want to highlight in this particular scenario is that, you know, when people's opportunity sets shift around in unexpected ways, this being a sort of particularly striking one, but one that affected a non-trivial sample of the kind of low-wage workers in this environment, this might primarily be labor supply, i.e. people voluntarily exiting in order to maintain their eligibility for insurance that's worth thousands of dollars. The week's looking result is sort of, the reason it bops around is that so much is that people are, you know, some months are coded as having 5 weeks in them and some months are coded as having 4 weeks in them. This result is much sort of, in terms of the statistical analysis, it's much less precisely estimated than the results on Medicaid participation and employment. But there is sort of a slightly marginal increase in job search that we observe among the people in the bound states relative to the people in the unbound state. So I'll show you sort of the specifics of that being relatively imprecise kind of at the very end. Okay, so the details in terms of the increases in the minimum wage, what I've divided the states out into these two groups. I'm following them in this survey of income program participation, which kicks into gear in July of 2008. So over this time period, you have there's a backdrop of the minimum wage having increased non-trivial in these states prior to the sample kicking into gear. Then during the sample, basically the only minimum wage changes that take effect were the ones that were associated with the binding federal increase. These people for whom I was just showing you all of these outcomes are people who I selected for being on Medicaid for 6 months between August 2008 and July 2009, at least 6 months, and whose average baseline wage over this period was less than $8.50, so that they're kind of disproportionately minimum wage types. And in the paper, we show you that we can provide pretty direct evidence, you know, of the minimum wage biting these people's wage distributions. The concerns that arise in this setting are sort of twofold. One is that the Great Recession is going on. That will be a concern for us to the extent that the Great Recession sort of plays out differentially across the bound and unbound states. Basically, the approach that we're going to take is, you know, to have a baseline where we do some stuff to control for that, and then to try to convince you that when we do anything else to control for that, that you suggest that it doesn't change the results. The second approach that, or the second concern, is that, as I was mentioning, this is a red states, blue states affair. where the blue states had slightly more generous Medicaid programs to begin with. The reason that matters is that that means that it would have been kind of easier to retain your Medicaid eligibility and employment in those states relative to the unbound states, which means that you might have expected the transitions off of Medicaid to look as they did, sort of even without this minimum wage interaction on which I'm focusing. So what I'm going to do in order to try to get a sense for whether that's a concern is I'm going to take similarly selected samples from earlier time periods and look at the transitions of these individuals over these earlier time periods where minimum wage increases were not going into effect. And to the extent that we don't see that sort of netting out the transitions from these earlier time periods kind of killing our results, this will, you know, for the econometricians, this will take a triple difference type of strategy, then we'll become at least more confident that that difference in eligibility thresholds isn't what's driving what we're seeing. Okay, so I'm going to fly through, sort of, I've already kind of walked through these general concerns. The econometric strategy is going to be a standard difference in difference strategy where I'm, you know, comparing changes in outcomes like Medicaid participation and employment in the bound states relative to the unbound states and then controlling for everything that you tell me you want me to control for if I can. And then the approach that's going to harness kind of earlier SIP panels is going to take a triple difference is going to be a triple difference strategy, which looks much more complicated, but basically it just means that relative to what I showed you in the graphs at the beginning, I'll just be netting out the transitions of that sort that we observe if we make those same graphs for earlier time periods. And the easiest way to see this will just be when I show you the graphs. Okay, I'll skip the wage distribution stuff and just get straight into these outcomes so that I can show you kind of exactly what I meant by what I just said. So this is the figure that I already showed you. So we saw this differential decline in people being able to be employed and retain Medicaid eligibility. This is the figure in which I show you how those same transitions unfolded during these earlier SIP panels. Now, one thing that I should say, so one thing that's unfortunate about earlier SIP panels is that they're all much shorter, so you can't track people for as long. So I'm not lopping this off at July 2007 because I don't want you to see what happened afterwards. There was no data collected afterwards. But so what we can see when we look at these time paths for the earlier periods is that in the earlier periods, people's sort of joint probability of being on Medicaid and employed basically moved in parallel when you compare the bound states to the unbound states. In the 2004 and 1996 panels in particular, a little bit noisier here in the 2001 panel. That's a case where it would be nice if the census had funded another year's worth of data collection so that we could see what was going on. Unfortunately, they didn't. What that means is that when we go from the difference in difference strategy that's just based on this graph to the strategy that nets out the differential transitions that you see in all these other graphs, it's basically going to have no effect on the estimate.
Yeah? Are based on the 2009 Medicaid definitions of bound and unbound.
It's based on being bound by the minimum wage increases. So essentially, if you were fully bound by both the second and third increments of those increases, then we code you up as being bound, as a bound state.
So that might be a different set per graph, essentially, a different set of states.
No, so it's always going to be the same division of. Sorry. So it's always the same group of states. The reason I've made these dashed instead of solid is to sort of highlight that these are like placebo changes. So it's the exact. Basically, I just take the earlier SIP panel, do the exact same sample construction procedure, and then look and see. You know, so if this went way down here, then I would say, okay.
It was a federal minimum wage increase in the 90s, right? I
think right, but it was. So it turns out that was not particularly differentially binding across states, and certainly not. So we checked that in the paper. It's not differentially binding across states in a way that correlates with this particular division of states. For the Medicaid participation, we see that it is, in fact, somewhat of a problem that the eligibility thresholds are different in these two groups of states. So when we look at the earlier time periods, individuals in bound states were slightly more likely than individuals in unbound states to transition off of Medicaid. And so what that tells us is that when we go to the triple difference framework, it is going to cut a little bit off of the estimate. Sort of interestingly, it turns out that's largely, as you might expect, given that there are these different eligibility thresholds, that's largely because people are kind of transitioning into something that's more like full-time employment at slightly higher wage rates, which is related to why the joint outcome of being on Medicaid and employed, you know, doesn't exhibit that particular problem. We have like 2 minutes left, or is that? Yeah. Okay. So The regression results basically show exactly that. There are a bunch of robustness checks, which I don't need to talk about. I want to say a little bit more about job search, because that's something that's kind of interesting in the context of some of the recent minimum wage discussion. So as you can see, the job search results are a little bit on the noisy side, so the statistical precision isn't going to be great. What's sort of the most intriguing thing that comes out of our analysis of job search is that, do you mind if I wrap up the job search point and then come back? Is that when we divide people's time that they report that they're looking for work into time looking for work while employed and time looking for work while unemployed, we see the kind of, and you know, this is one statistically significant result in a table with many results, but sort of the one that pops out is looking while employed, which is something that was very much predicted by the kind of particulars of this theoretical setup that I was giving you, namely that some people are going to find it attractive to start looking for work while they're still at this job that they prefer to being unemployed and having the benefit, but it's a job that's not going to let them maintain eligibility for the benefit. What's interesting about that is that that's suggestive evidence that sort of pushes in the direction of there being this kind of very peculiar budget set interaction going on, because this is the opposite of what you would predict in kind of the standard minimum wage setting, namely that if the minimum wage goes up and you still have a job, then your job has gotten better, and if anything, alternative employment opportunities may have dried up a little bit on the outside. And so in general, the minimum wage literature predicts, you know, lower turnover as the minimum wage increases, and that would mean less time that you're working in one job and feverishly looking for employment in another job. It's sort of particular to the scenario that I'm analyzing, where being in that job means that you're about to fall short a few thousand in terms of the value of the Medicaid benefit that you're about to lose access to. So it's kind of a unique prediction. I wish it was more statistically significant, but that's sort of what we got. Okay, so with that, I'll wrap up so that we can take a few questions. So what we've done here is we've tracked the employment, Medicaid participation, and job search of low-wage Medicaid beneficiaries following some non-trivial minimum wage increases. And the findings all seem generally consistent. So there are some sort of, you know, potential ways that you could push and prod them, but they all seem generally consistent with thinking about the low-skilled labor market as being a world where people do face pretty significant adjustment frictions. Whether it's because, you know, there's sort of a lag in recognizing what's happened to your opportunity sets and your program rules, or because it's difficult to actually find a new job that would be kind of your new best labor market outcome. So what do we conclude from this? Well, because it's difficult for people to reoptimize as budget constraints change, tinkering around with program parameters in ways that aren't what we would think of as meaningful reforms can be costly. And that's going to mean that there would be benefits from, you know, finally choosing a safety net design and kind of locking it in, and then also potentially from simplifying the safety net so that as it does change, people will have sort of less effort that they have to exert to figure out what exactly is going on. Okay, so I'll wrap up there and take some questions. Yeah, I guess, right, you had a question 5 minutes ago.
So can you go back to one of the slides we had on before, like the panel A, B, C, D? Yeah, something like
comparing that. Across SIP panels or the one that had the full set of outcomes?
All the 2008 panels?
Yeah.
So, like, for panel A and B, your differential, your pre-trends are basically right on top of each other. And C, they're kind of credible. But for D, they're moving in the opposite direction. You're still claiming that's due to noise, but that just...
No. So I totally take that critique. So the noise is why sometimes it spikes a little bit. That's the 5 weeks, 4 weeks thing. So this is the number of weeks looking per month. But yeah, so I completely agree that when you look at that, you should think, oh, okay, yeah, there is some difference in the amount of labor market search that's happening at baseline between...
Well, it's not only baseline. One goes up, the other goes down.
Yeah, that's... Well, so this is that... This is definitely unique to the blue guys. Yeah, so there are some differences there that.
I mean, because there's something that's like less noise than noise.
Right. I guess I could. It might be worth constructing a version of this figure, which at least sort of gets rid of the 4 weeks, 5 weeks issue by just doing it as the kind of binary. Did you spend any time looking for work during this month? Yeah.
So how much bunching is there at these Medicaid notches, like in our So in the extreme case that, imagine that everybody in like the state was like right under this threshold, then it seems like policymakers would be unlikely to, move everybody over and like have them lose their eligibility. So are we more likely to see minimum wage increases in areas that there isn't that much bunching going on? And then the second question was just a question on incidence. Related to that idea where, like, if everybody is going to get kicked off these, or just, move over the eligibility threshold, would employers then, like, offer jobs that have more flexibility so that they could sort of remain under or, like, adjust their hours or something like that?
Right.
Versus, like, if it's just, this is, like, a small percentage of the population, then maybe employers wouldn't design jobs like that.
Yeah. So on the first point, I would go back to my hemming and hawing about the measurement error and the difficulties of even just monitoring the eligibility rules. And at least in the SIP data, you wouldn't find any bunching, reflecting both kind of measurement error and self-reported earnings, but also the fact that the labor market participation of low-skilled folks, exhibits a great deal of volatility on a kind of month-to-month basis. Was there more to the first question? I'm really riding on you being willing to kind of entertain this as a scenario where this sort of broad population group that I'm looking at, because the minimum wage changes, sort of including the sort of earlier increments, it's contracting the number of hours that you can work while maintaining Medicaid eligibility by 40%. So that's a big chunk, and it's going to shift a lot of people who weren't literally bunched into this scenario. And that relates to the So what was the specifics of the second point?
Oh, just the incidence. Would, like,
yeah. So I think very very much in line with the kind of the Danish tax data. Raj's work on this is very much on point on that. Yeah. So if you were in a labor market segment where a lot of people were likely to end up in this kind of situation, I would expect the kind of contracting institutions to evolve in a way that, or at least you would hope that they would evolve in a way that would help people work this out. In this particular setting, I do think that because these Medicaid eligibility thresholds are so low, and then again, as I was, emphasizing, to the extent that these states have not adopted ACA Medicaid expansions, they continue to be that low for this group. They're just, I think that, like, once it's gotten down to the point where we're talking about 10 hours of work a week, it's more an issue of there not really being steady jobs that take that form. So it's not clear that you would even be, in the Danish case with the analysis of the bunching at the kinks, that's very much a kind of, it's these huge unions collectively bargaining for over contracts for, for like 10% of the or more of the population, and it's kind of, it's sort of full-time employed kind of middle income folks. It's like the teachers and other groups of that sort. So and that is probably, I can use that as a plug for this paper, or just for looking at this market, learning more about what's going on with contracting flexibility and flexibility along other margins in this sort of very particular but important segment, an understudied segment of the labor market, is probably something that we should all be, spending more time on.
So with the ACA expansion, this will all go in the other direction, right? Because now, if you're a parent, you have, in these states, you have no eligibility between 50 and 100% FPL. And if you're single, you have no eligibility under 100% FPL.
Right.
If you cross 100 and you, in the non-expanding states, then you can get access to the exchanges. So we would expect in the next SIP.
That's right. So
if you're right here, we should see employment.
Right, you might. It'll be a
disconnect in the non-expanding.
Yeah, you might see some. You might see some pushing in towards full time and some pushing in the other direction. That's absolutely right.
And then in the expansion states, it all depends on how people relatively value Medicaid versus the exchange.
That's right. So there is something that qualifies as seamless insurance support,
so,
but
it's not an argument for that we follow the Canadians and stop playing these games.
Make it simple. Thank you.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.